Hi, I'm Planta on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. When you don't go to interviewing school, you really steal from the personalities one has watched growing up. The Late Late Show debuted in 1995 in the middle of my grade 8 year. Tom Snyder was the host, and in those days when I was finding myself up far too late, I started watching the guy who came on after Letterman on CBS. I was drawn into his style of storytelling and conversation. He was compelling, riveting stuff. I went back and learned a little more about him. Sometimes he would tell stories about hosting the old Tomorrow Show on NBC, which really made him a household name in the 1970s. From time to time, he'd tell stories about anchoring the evening news in New York at WABC or in Los Angeles at KNBC. He was a real television personality who was as talented as he was captivating. He wasn't like his opposite number at NBC, Conan O'Brien, who did skits and comedy like every other late-night host. In fact, it was just Snyder, him, and a camera. There were some people chuckling from behind the cameras, but it was really just Snyder, the guest if there was one, and the rest of us watching at home. After he left The Late Late Show in 1999, he was succeeded by Craig Kilborn. Then Craig Ferguson was on for a decade or so, and lately it's been James Corden at 12:30. I've grown to miss his presence, so I have bought all the DVDs, compilations from the Tomorrow Show days, and thanks to YouTube, there are all sorts of interviews. There's the memorable Alfred Hitchcock one and the infamous Charles Manson one. He didn't just interview celebrities, he also covered the news if there was a development in the O.J. Simpson trial or devastation in Oklahoma City. Tom Snyder took the time to report it and talk about it. Michael Horowitz was there through the CBS years and the couple of years he was at CNBC. In fact, he first worked with Snyder in the early 1980s at WABC in New York, where Snyder was anchoring and he was a producer. This was in the days of Eyewitness News with anchors like Roger Grimsby and Bill Butel. Mr. Horowitz joins me now as we remember Tom Snyder, a larger-than-life figure in television, who was also quite tall. He stood 6'4". Snyder died 10 years ago this week at the age of 71, the 29th of July, which, incidentally, is Michael's birthday. Michael's Twitter handle is at Michael Horowitz. He is a veteran of news and has produced for personalities such as Geraldo Rivera, Tavis Smiley, and many others. Tom Snyder's skill as an interviewer is unmatched, and he is a much-missed personality. We taped this interview last Thursday morning as we all waited the result of O.J. Simpson's parole hearing. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Michael Horowitz. Mr. Horowitz, good morning.
How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
All right.
So it'll be this Saturday, the 29th, will be the 10th anniversary of Snyder's death, but it'll also be your birthday, is that right?
Uh-huh.
I should wish you a happy birthday first, shouldn't I?
Yes, you should. And it also is very poignant that we are doing this interview obviously a couple of days in advance, while we're waiting for O.J. Simpson's parole hearing decision to be announced.
That's right.
Even as we speak, they're deciding whether he's going to get out of jail or not, and it's like Throwback Thursday. We're all going back 20 years and talking about Tom, and O.J.'s on the TV. It's all very it's very bittersweet and melancholy.
Yeah. So when did you, I guess you first encountered him watching The Tomorrow Show, like a lot of people did. When was it that you first met him, though?
I first met him the day he came to WABC TV Channel 7 Eyewitness News in New York. The Tomorrow Show had been canceled, and Tom was out of work. I was 19 or 20 years old, working as a news writer at Channel 7. So in high school, doing homework, I'd watch The Tomorrow Show all the time late at night. And then it was announced in August of 1981, I believe, you can double-check me, that Tom was coming to do the 11 o'clock news at my TV station, and I was floored. And we became friends very quickly. So that was where I first met him.
Yeah, I guess we all know him from, most people know him from The Tomorrow Show. I know him because I watched him in high school doing The Late Late Show. But before that, he was a reporter, wasn't he? A news anchor at various stations through the United States. Is that right?
Absolutely. That was his main foundation in television. He'd been an anchorman in Philadelphia. He had a long, successful run in Los Angeles. And I think he started in Savannah, Georgia, and then went to Atlanta.
Yeah. I read, I think it's, no, I actually saw this during the Hitchcock interview that he did for the Tomorrow Show. He had, was he Catholic, or did he just go to Jesuit school?
He was Catholic.
He was Catholic, but was he a practicing, like, was he religious at all in the years that you knew him?
No, he didn't go to, it's not like he went to church on Sundays, but I will tell you this, that when we had that lunch with Howard Stringer at the time, who was president of CBS, and he was making the move from CNBC to CBS.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have been sometime in the summer of 1994. Tom had lunch with Howard Stringer, and afterwards I met up with him, and we walked straight to St. Patrick's Cathedral, where Tom lit a candle. So he was religious when it counted, I guess.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Channel 7 at WABC. I mean, for people that don't, I mean, I'm talking from Canada, but I mean, I realize what a big deal Eyewitness News was in the 70s and the 80s. That was Roger Grimsby and Bill Butel. So you worked with those guys as a producer, and then Snyder comes along. Is that right?
Exactly.
And was Channel 7, was that the number one station in New York at the time, the biggest market in the States?
Absolutely. Number one in the market, therefore number one in the country, therefore number one in the world. But that's a whole other podcast we could go on.
Yeah.
On and on, and maybe we should.
Yeah, you know, one of the guys that I've always been fascinated with, and I watched clips of him, is the guy that was on CBS, Jim Jensen. Because I guess he had a lot of problems, didn't he, off air?
Geez, another one of those characters. But in those days, Channel 2, where Jim Jensen worked, was very stiff. My impression, and I had friends who worked there, was that anybody who was working at Channel 2 at WCBS was really dying to move upstairs to CBS News.
Yeah.
And therefore, this was treated like a AAA farm team. And I didn't get the impression that there were too many people at WCBS who considered local TV news a career in itself. And it showed on the air.
Yeah. Well, when Tom Snyder gets to WABC and does the news there, you mentioned earlier the Tomorrow Show had been canceled. He was looking for work. I mean, were his spirits, were they down at all? Because you go from late night, you know, following Johnny Carson to doing the news in New York City. I mean, did that hurt at all for him?
He never showed it in public. As he and I grew closer, and we developed a friendship, he would confide in me. But he was a guy who, you know, had this wonderful show, and then they ruined it. You know, they brought in Rona Barrett, and the late Roger Ailes was going crazy with ideas that would never have worked with Tom, and he was embarrassed with the show at the end.
Yeah.
It wasn't the Tomorrow Show as he developed it, and so what I'm saying is that there is sadness, and there was also relief, and all Tom wanted to do was make a living and be on TV, but even Tom was perplexed as to why he was hired at Channel 7. The 11 o'clock news was doing very well with the current anchors that they had there. And he would say all the time, because even I watched Roseanne and Ernie, who were the anchors he replaced.
Yeah.
But he needed a job, and doing the 11 o'clock news in New York wasn't, you know, it wasn't a bad way to land after losing the Tomorrow Show. But there was a lot of, he was perplexed as to why he was there, but we moved forward.
Yeah.
And it's funny you mentioned WCBS. If he had been hired by WCBS, he would have been a lot more successful, because WCBS would have, they probably would have changed to adapt to Tom. But Eyewitness News, its roots were in the neighborhoods and in the you know, Geraldo Rivera started there, so they had, you know, a huge African American audience, Puerto Rican audience, ethnic audience, and Tom was this white guy from Milwaukee. And to make matters worse, I'm sure you've seen the ad. They to introduce Tom to the market, they had Jerry Delafamina, who is one of the greatest advertising brilliant mind. He was the guy after whom the John Hamm character in
Mad Men.
Mad Men was made after. Jerry Delafamina created this print ad for Tom, and Jerry is one of my dearest friends, and many times I had Jerry on the show with Tom to discuss the giant ad, and we had the giant ad there on the set, and it was basically a big picture of Tom, and the words were, he's caustic, he's obnoxious,
yeah,
he's argumentative, he's this, he's that, and on the bottom it says, he's New York. Well, this went over not very well, because you're basically saying that every New Yorker is caustic, obnoxious, argumentative, and you know, you'd be standing there waiting on the subway on 66th Street, and you'd see these, you know, they would plaster the entire station with these ads, and it obviously it backfired, and it went downhill from there, and it just was never managed well. But out of that terrible experience for him, I became friends with him for life, and so something really, really wonderful happened to me as a result of that. To call it a mismatch is an understatement.
Yeah. So he would share things with you. Did he? Did you get any insight as to why he and Rona Barrett didn't get along?
I don't. First of all, I think Tom was in New York and she was in
Hollywood,
in
right?
Los Angeles.
Yeah.
But when you're doing a 90-minute show later, it was an hour, all by yourself. I think the very fact that you're getting any co-anchor, it's not going to be the best chemistry because you're giving up your airtime.
Yeah.
I have a friend who likes to say that airtime is currency, so it wouldn't make a difference whoever it was. But Rona Barrett would do gossip, and you know, Tom was a journalist. Tom was an interviewer, and so the idea of him not just giving up half the show, but giving up half the show to somebody who was going to do gossip. And then, from what I remember, it was like watching two different shows.
Yeah.
It just didn't work.
Yeah. Now, did he and Johnny Carson get along?
Yes. I mean, Snyder was a guest on Carson's show a lot. In fact, when it was announced that Tom was going to WABC after he'd been off the air for several months, Carson did a joke in his monologue and said, have you heard Tom Snyder's going to anchor the news at 11 o'clock in New York? And then there was a pause. And then Carson said, and Charles Manson will be doing the weather. and I'm watching this and I'm thinking, oh, my God, Tom Snyder's coming to our station. This is a huge celebrity. But you have to remember they both have the same agent with Ed Hook Stratton. There was an anecdote in Bushkin's book, the bombastic Bushkin.
The Carson biography, yeah.
Yes. There's a story in that book about how Carson tried to pick a fight at Chasen's one night when Snyder was eating there alone. That's the first I'd heard of that.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you if that was true, Tom would have told me. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to make any judgment, but even friends could have could try to pick a fight. But I'd never. I think Tom idolized Johnny because when he came back up to the newsroom and while we were doing the 11 o'clock news at WABC, Tom would come back up at 11:30 and go into his office, pour himself a drink, and we'd sit there and just watch Johnny And I could see Tom was mesmerized. It was obvious to me that Tom had a lot of respect for Carson. And, you know, Carson had had enough power, probably the most powerful person at NBC at the time, where if Johnny really wanted to squash Tom, he could have.
Now, you mentioned hanging out with him, drinking with him. That must have been fun because, I mean, he when we watch him on television, he was a fun guy.
It's impossible to overstate how much fun there was. What was sad about it is that the others in the newsroom didn't know what to make of Tom. So it was me and another a guy by the name of Bill Diedrich, and we were not afraid of Tom. We loved Tom, so we would hang out with him. It took a long time, if ever, for others in the newsroom to warm up to him. Tom was huge. What was he, like 6'4", 6'5". And there was considerable concern that if you hung out with Tom, that the other anchors would get upset and that there would be accusations of divided loyalty. So there were basically just the two of us and a couple others who we gravitated to Tom, and we'd sit there at 11:30 after the news was off the air and try to picture this. A giant IV bottle, an intravenous bottle, but with vodka inside. It was a craze back then. It was a thing called MASH vodka. You could get it at the liquor store, and there was a tube coming out of it. And he had this resting on top of the TV set in his office, and we'd drink out of that MASH vodka. And then he had somebody called the Beer Fairy, which was his secretary. And when the Beer Fairy came, there was beer in the refrigerator, and we'd sit there until 1 o'clock, and he would teach us how to play blackjack.
Huh.
And he would say, "You don't need to go to Atlantic City." And it was me, Bill, and Tom, and he would give us these great blackjack tips that I remember to this day. And we'd sit there and hang out, and these are treasured memories that I have. You know, we're talking 1982,
yeah.
And as I sit here and talk to you, they come back as if they were yesterday. Now I want to tell you something else that nobody has ever known, and I wish that the people knew the people involved. But the dean of that television station was a guy by the name of Roger Grimsby, and he owned the newsroom. He were really tough. I spent many years just trying to get his approval, quite frankly. But when you're 19, 20, 21 years old, these things are very important. And everybody thought that there were going to be problems between Roger and Tom. And I got sent to Ethiopia during the famine with Roger. And we were sitting there and we were talking about Tom. And Roger said, you know, I have no problem with Tom. He's straight up.
Yeah.
And then he said to me, and I also have a top banana clause. So whatever Tom's making, I got to make $1 more. So then I went back to New York, and I went back to Tom, and I told Tom, you know, Roger had a very nice, we had a very nice conversation about you. And Snyder had told me this story, which I don't think anybody knows, is that Tom's first day at Channel 7, he marched into Roger's office before they went on the air and said, look, Roger, I know this is your place. I know you own this place. I know you're the king, and I'm behind you in the lineup. I don't even know why I'm here, but I need the job and I need the money, and I just want you to know that I'm never going to get in your way. And this was a conversation that the two of them had, and Tom basically diffused the situation before there ever was a situation. I'm not saying there ever was.
Yeah.
And they got along, and they actually went drinking occasionally.
Yeah. Hey, he was
the kind of guy Tom. Tom was adept at avoiding the politics.
Yeah, and Grimsby was known as a great drinker, and you know, he worked hard, but he also lived hard as well, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. I will remember being in the back seat of a car one day, and I forgot where we were driving, but we were pulling up to a toll booth, and the two of them, I'm in the back seat, the two of them are totally soft, and Roger was behind the wheel, and he took, well, I'm not, who knows, Roger probably held his liquor very well. I don't want to create the impression that he was driving drunk, but could be. And he rolled down the windows and said to the toll taker, "Fill it up high test, please." I'm like, okay. But the moral of the story is, that there was great concern that these two would butt heads, and of course it never happened.
And he was quite adept, too, in terms of the politics of late night when you guys go to CBS, because, I mean, everybody's watching what's going to happen with 12:30. This is just after the Leno Letterman stuff. And he does very well for himself in those years that he was host of the Late Late Show, right?
Sure. Because this was not anything that we discussed. You know, we'd sit there, we'd talk, and that CNBC show was the best thing that ever happened to us. And he's on the air four nights a week, no show on Friday. And his boss, the guy he reported to, was a guy by the name of Andy Friendly, who idolized Tom, and they went back even further. When Tom was at WNBC in New York in 1974, Andy Friendly was a young disciple of Tom's and was a writer for him on the 11 o'clock news. So, you know, Andy winds up reuniting with Tom at CNBC, and when I got hired, Andy looked at me and he said, "You have one assignment, keep Tom happy." Mm. So when that's your environment, where your boss is a guy who looks up to you and your producer is a guy whose basically assignment was keep Tom happy, we had a wonderful time.
Yeah.
And Tom always loved saying, "I love doing little TV. I don't like doing big TV." Not that little TV is any less difficult or anything less important, but in fact, some might say it's a lot more difficult, because Tom didn't have a studio audience, he doesn't have a band, he doesn't have a co-host, he's got to do it all by himself, and that's the way he liked it. But we went and we did little TV on CNBC, and it was the last thing on anybody's mind when David Letterman sought to make things right in his mind. And you know, there was a lot of talk that David Letterman didn't want another comic on after him because he didn't want to be compared to another comic.
Yeah.
He didn't want the competition, so he went with Tom Snyder. That was a theory. I don't think it's true. I think David Letterman always had a great respect for Snyder. David Letterman probably had more than a little guilt in having replaced Tom Snyder at 12:30. At NBC,
mm-hmm.
and wanted to make it right. And all of a sudden, I mean, we're talking about taking the CNBC show back to Fort Lee, New Jersey, where CNBC was headquartered. We were going to go back to New York once a month. We're talking about plans for the Christmas party. This is late 1994. We're not talking about going to CBS. And then it started out of nowhere.
Yeah. Well, was Roger Ailes at CNBC when you guys were there?
Yes, he was the president.
Yeah, and then I guess he starts, what was the name of the thing that became MSNBC? Was it like America's Talk, right?
America's Talking.
Yeah, America's Talking, yeah. And so did he and Ailes got along, right?
I think they gave each other a wide berth.
I see.
I don't think that, I mean, I never witnessed any, I mean, Roger never told us what to do, never told us, never gave us any feedback, and I appreciate that. You know, Roger would come to L.A. every once in a while. We'd have to have drinks with him. You know, Tom was extremely wary of Roger because it didn't go well at the Tomorrow Show. At the end, it was Roger. At the end of the Tomorrow Show,
mm-hmm.
it was Roger who came up with all these crazy ideas. So my impression was that they gave each other a wide berth, and thank God for that.
Yeah. Now, the CNBC show, he would have a guest, sometimes two guests, and there would be calls. And that essentially was the format that you guys took to Television City for the Late Late Show, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, was there pressure to change that when you guys go to CBS from the network side?
Of course there was, but they didn't know what they wanted. I mean, they said point blank, take the CNBC show and do it at CBS. But as, you know, and I don't really blame anybody, but, you know, ratings become an issue. You wind up having new bosses at new expectations at CBS. So all of a sudden, you know, Tom's favorite guest, one of his favorite guests of CNBC, was a guy by the name of Mr. Brisket, who would come on the air and talk meat.
Hmm.
I mean, this is years before the Food Network, the Food Channel, even the Travel Channel now does food shows. But Tom's mantra, whenever we had a guest who canceled, Tom says, book a chef. Everybody eats. Yeah. I know all these great chefs. Everybody eats. So we would sit and we would talk about food. And Mr. Brisket was just a guy who'd come on with 8 different cuts of meat, 12 different ideas on how to prepare it, and he was filled with anecdotes, and we'd be great, and the ratings would go through the roof.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't bring up in a booking, once we went to CBS, you would not bring up in a meeting, hey, let's book Mr. Brisket. And Mr. Brisket never showed up on CBS.
Yeah.
So, yes, was there pressure? There was an undercurrent of the idea that you couldn't, were certain things you couldn't do at CBS that were wildly successful at CNBC.
And by this time, when you knew him and you worked for him, was he smoking then?
Oh, yeah. We'd go back out before the show, and he'd have one cigarette before the show.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's what people remember him from the Tomorrow Show, was the smoking on camera, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
No, I remember we'd go out at 5 o'clock, and when there were two other smokers on the staff, and we'd go outside Burbank and on the street. And it was wonderful because we were all together, and we could kind of brief him on the show.
Yeah.
I took that 5 minutes and say, okay, now we got Alec Baldwin coming on. And I got his high school yearbook, so, and it was. You know, it was productive time. It may not have been productive for his health, I'm sorry to say, but it was productive for that night's program.
And the preparation that he would do for an interview, I mean, was that because when you watch him on television, it seemed he made it look easy. Now I've been doing this for a while. I'm wondering if making it look easy also involves a lot of preparation, and I'm assuming it does. Or was he just as widely read as he appeared to be, that he could just...
He was extremely widely read, and we'd have a quick phone call at 11:30, which didn't really amount to much. We'd talk about what he'd be doing at 11:30 would be trying out anecdotes for his monologue that
night. Yeah.
And since we were a live show, we had the ability to change topics, and we hardly ever did. But so he'd try out some stuff for his monologue, and we'd talk about that morning's news just a little bit, because maybe once a month we would book a newsmaker guest, maybe a little more often, maybe a little less often, certainly a little more often during the OJ thing. But so we had that conversation, but. You know, I'm old school, and the rule was that nobody got on the air without a lengthy pre-interview.
Mm.
And we had 3 segment producers, and I would handle a couple of guests a week as well. And everyone had an office, and every producer would close. The one legitimate excuse for missing a meeting or even missing the show would be you had to do a pre-interview. And the producer, he or she, would go into their office, tape a note on the door saying pre-interview, and you came out with a page and a half of notes, and Tom always read them, always took something out of them. Sometimes
yeah.
He'd go into his own, he had his own ideas, but he always read the notes, and nobody ever got on the air without a pre-interview.
Yeah.
One day, Andy Rooney hung up on me. He was already 150 years old.
Yeah.
But I had read the book. It was a book about his days as a reporter on Stars and Stripes.
Right.
And so I'd already read the book, so I managed to cobble together notes from the book because this old guy was hung up on me. So that's the only exception I could think of. And he read the notes. And then he'd sit there and, before the show, but an hour before the show, this is at CNBC or at CBS, and he would type, he would write on an index card these one-word notes.
Yeah.
That he would give me the card, and we'd put it on prompter, on the teleprompter. So he'd look up, and there would be a note that said Stars and Stripes, for example.
Yeah.
Or it would say DJ, and you'd scroll down. And those were reminders to him of where he wanted to go with the interview. And he used them 50% of the time. Tom would never wear an earpiece.
Mm.
And only occasionally would I type something on the teleprompter that I thought was really, really important. And that wasn't because I was hesitant to, but it was because when I had something important, I would bring it up to him beforehand in the cigarette meeting or in the makeup chair, and he would listen to me. I mean, Tom's mantra on the show was everybody gets one. And I say that to this day, because, look, I might not be interested in auto racing, because I remember canceling Dale Earnhardt. He came in and said, why are you canceling Dale Earnhardt? Because I know you hate NASCAR. And he goes, it's okay. I'll do it. Because everybody gets one.
Yeah.
So he was very, we loved him because he appreciated the effort and listened to us and took our suggestions as well as his own.
Yeah.
So we went off on a tangent. Yes, the preparation was there. It was unorthodox. It took many forms. We'd start talking about the guests weeks ahead when we booked them or her.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about it the night before. We talk about it that morning. We talk about it at the cigarette meeting. But it was never anything formal. It was just fun. And, you know, don't forget to ask so-and-so about such and such. You'll get a great answer. And he goes, okay, you know. And he was, in addition to being well-read, he appreciated our suggestions and aggregated them into the interview because, quote-unquote, everybody gets one.
Now, the night that Robert McNamara comes on, and he'd written a book about the Vietnam War, the interview with Snyder was nothing about the Vietnam War, if I recall.
Yes. And I was reading the book, and Tom loved the 60s, and he was the champion of that booking. Is get McNamara. I said, of course.
Yeah.
So I was influenced by his enthusiasm. I started reading the book, and, you know, McNamara was responsible for the running of the Vietnam War, and there was so much controversy. And now here was Robert McNamara, the former defense secretary, basically apologizing, and he's saying he was wrong about most of his thoughts on Vietnam, and it was fantastic. But Tom took it upon himself to talk about another part of McNamara's life. He was, and I don't remember if it was before or after, you know, I apologize, but he was also the chief executive of the Ford Motor Company.
Mm.
And that's Ford, that's Detroit, that's Middle America, that's Tom's roots. And Tom spent most of the interview talking about that part of McNamara, and talking about the Edsel, and talking about the fins on the car, and the taillights. I mean, you could see Tom's face light up, and he's taking this in a completely another direction. And afterwards, Tom says to me, look, this is McNamara. He's doing a book tour.
Mm.
And he's talking about Vietnam with everybody in the world. What am I going to do that's different? Let me do something different. And I said, fine, man. Go ahead. That's what we're here for.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful interview. It was a wonderful interview. But you wonder whether anybody today would have the guts to go in a different direction with a guy like that.
Right.
Even though he's on a book tour. I mean, what's he going to say about Vietnam to Tom that was going to be different and then have be a great revelation as opposed to what he was saying to, you know, Brokaw and Rather, et cetera, and everybody else. And that's what I loved. That's what I loved about it.
Yeah.
Which brings us to another anecdote.
Mm-hmm.
What's the Tom Hanks movie? Life is a Kabak.
Oh, Forrest Gump. Forrest Gump. Yeah.
Forrest Gump is by far the number one movie that summer, 93, 94, I don't remember. Everyone's talking about it. Everybody. And the staff is going crazy. We're trying to book Sally Field. We're trying to book Tom Hanks. We're getting nowhere. And Tom comes into the booking meeting, and he just strolls in, you know, and this, this lanky guy. And you just can't help but smile when he comes in. And he goes, what the hell are you guys working so hard for? Forget all the way. We are not getting Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks is not coming on his show. Sally Field is not coming on his show. But that other guy, the guy who was from Bubba Shrimp, the guy, you know, we got boiled shrimp, we got fried shrimp, we got, he says, that guy stole the show. Get that guy.
Yeah.
What was his name? Michael T. Williamson, I think. Get that guy. You know, this is our way of covering the movie. It's our way of covering this phenomenon. It's our way of getting the guests. Let's just get somebody else. He has to be, you know, that guy's got a great story because he's such a great actor.
Yeah.
So we did, and of course it was easy to book the other guys.
Uh-huh.
Easy. Nobody was asking for Bubba to come on the show. And the interview was a home run. It was great. We had shrimp, of course. And they're having a conversation, which is something we should get into later. They're not having an interview.
Yeah.
They're having a conversation, and it was wonderful. And what do you think happened the next morning? I get a voicemail from Debbie Vickers, who was the executive producer of The Tonight Show with Jay Leno.
Yeah.
She's asking for a VHS of Bubba to play in her booking meeting because they saw how great he was with Tom, and now they want him for the...
for The Tonight Show.
For The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, this is a lesson. The lesson I learned, because I've done many, many talk shows that could not command an appearance by the big guy, and say another star of the movie, and I've never been disappointed.
Yeah.
I forgot what was Cameron Diaz's first movie.
Well, was there's Something About Mary was the one that really made her famous, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't remember. We're going, but Tom had seen the movie. It may have been a movie before. Let's not look it up now. But
yeah.
And there was this young woman named Cameron Diaz. She's 23, 24 years old. And Tom comes in Monday morning, and I think he had seen her in a movie. Maybe he had seen her on a talk show. But no, he hadn't seen her. So, seen her in a movie and says, this woman's going to be a star. Book her. And... okay, you know, the idea of discovering somebody, the idea of going into uncharted territory was something that was so great for him and became great for me and the rest of the staff. And we booked this young Cameron Diaz, and she was just so bubbly and effervescent. And all of a sudden, people all over the company are descending upon me. Get us a VHS, Cam. I'm at the Today Show, the Tonight Show. Costas. Everybody wants to book Cameron Diaz. But the sad thing is, they had so much pressure on their shows, they couldn't afford to book a Cameron Diaz.
Right.
And they were unwilling to spend an hour with her on the phone and do a free interview to find out. And we were. And we were little groundbreakers on this little show on CNBC, and I loved that so much.
So what was it like then when the guest would come in and talk to him? And then I guess you or someone else would see them out. Would they tell you what the experience was like for them having just been interviewed by, or have a conversation with Tom Snyder?
Oh, always. But first and foremost, we had an 8-minute segment, then we had a 7-minute segment. So they're getting 15 minutes of airtime.
Yeah.
And almost always they'd come out and they'd say, whoa, this guy's brilliant, talking about Tom.
Yeah.
And but it wasn't an interview. It wasn't an interview. It was a conversation. And this is the part that I struggle with doing TV 20 years later, because let's just take Megyn Kelly,
mm-hmm.
who is fantastic on a Fox show where you've got 5 minutes and you're trying to get sound bites. You're trying to get newsworthy sound bites that will be reused later in the day. And she's in there, and she's got the goods, and she's saying, well, what about this? What about that? What is your opinion on this? And she's going down a list of questions with a purpose of trying to make news. That's doing an interview. I'm not criticizing that. That's what she needs to do. And when she was on that Fox show, she was fantastic.
Yeah.
Tom had no such intentions, no such impressions. Tom was doing a conversation. This might as well have been at a bar with no cameras, and he would say, tell me about Chicago. Did you go to Gene and Giorgetti, which is a famous steakhouse in Chicago? Right. What'd you have? Because that porterhouse for two, I mean, when you order the porterhouse for two, it looks like it's a piece of the cow. It looks like it came from the cow. And they start talking about steak restaurants in Chicago. And there was nothing in the notes and nothing in anybody's pre-interview that talked about this. But the guest would be from Chicago. I'm just using this as an example. And he decided they were going to talk about meat. And they had a wonderful conversation. But, you know, we're talking about, my mind's gone, the Fahrenheit 451, the great novelist.
Ray Bradbury,
and Harlan Ellison, who was one of his favorite guests, and they would talk about stuff, you know, really almost bordering on science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, this was late night. This was the Tomorrow Show. As Tom always said about late night television, your audience, never forget your audience. It's the jokers and the smokers and the drinkers and the thinkers.
Mm.
We had a guy on once. He was a head of Mensa. And he floated the idea, not that it was going to do anything, but he floated the idea of that maybe you take people who are developmentally disabled, you take people with a low IQ, and you set them aside. Thin the herd. Now, obviously, this is the most disgusting thing you can think of, and it brings all kinds of terrible connotations, and we discussed that. And the guy said, look, I'm not saying we should do it. I'm just saying that this is a way of controlling and a way of giving them help and aid. And, you know, we would take on topics that were so out there, not from left, not constantly, but they were from left field, and not like in the way that an overnight radio show would do these days, but with respect. And it would be interesting. You'd hear stuff you wouldn't hear anywhere else.
Yeah. And a lot of that had to do with, I guess, the wide berth that you all got from the Letterman people, right? Because Letterman really revered Tom as a broadcaster, and that's the kind of show that he wanted at 12:30.
We got what we wanted once we got to CBS, but we had to work harder to get it on the air.
Yeah. And so was there direction from say, the people at Worldwide Pants as to how the show should be? I mean, you mentioned...
They had conflict because there'd be people there who'd say, this is ridiculous, we're not having Mr. Brisket on the air. And then there'd be other people at Worldwide Pants who'd say, leave him alone.
Yeah.
So, like I said, we usually got what we wanted. I don't remember any great... Oh, I remember great fights all the time. But we usually got what we wanted. I remember wanting to book Courtney Cox.
Mm.
Yeah, and this is 1995. So Friends is the hottest thing in the world. And one of the executive producers, the longtime Tonight Show producer, Peter LaSalle, saying, no, that's not a good booking. What are they going to talk about? And I remember him giving me enough rope to hang myself eventually. And he said, all right, you can do the booking, but this is not going to go work out well. They have nothing in common. What is Courtney Cox going to talk about with Tom Snyder? And, you know, I'm still a kid. I don't really care about my own reputation. I wanted to do this. I really wasn't thinking big picture. I said, just let me do this. Give me enough rope to hang myself. And lo and behold, Courtney Cox comes on the show, and what do they talk about is home renovation.
Mm.
Tom wasn't a fan of Friends, never really watched it, but Tom was renovating his house. Courtney was renovating her house, and they have a wonderful conversation about sawdust and contractors and hammers and nails and noise at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I didn't even know it was coming, but it was wonderful.
Yeah.
It was wonderful. But I guarantee you, before or since, Courtney Cox never did an interview where she talked about home renovation. And there was no need for games like they do on the Fallon show or Ellen, and I'm not criticizing them, but
yeah.
Tom never needed to contrive. There were no quizzes. There was no nothing. He was just Tom and the guest and a conversation. He did not go, you know, question number one and question number two. Tom would listen. Obviously, I don't remember, but obviously Courtney Cox must have said something about renovating her house. And Tom just took it up from there. I guarantee it never came up in the pre-interview,
yeah.
But he took it from there because he listened. And I just worry that these days there is so much pressure because they literally spend a week booking somebody on a show these days, and they give them 3.5 minutes.
Yeah.
And these days interviews just go so fast, and they try to cram so much in. They try to make news. And just have a conversation, sit there and talk.
Yeah. Did Snyder realize how good he was?
I hope so. I mean, in the 80s, when we had him on Eyewitness News, there was an arrogance about him. And in the newsroom, he'd walk in at 3 o'clock, and he would bang his hand on the desk and say, "Good afternoon, staff." And then the staff would have to sit down and say, "Good afternoon, Tom." And, you know, there were other staffs, there were other pods in the newsroom, they're working on other broadcasts with other anchors, and Tom would sit there and do a monologue in the newsroom every day at 3 o'clock, and we'd sit there mesmerized. But there were other people there who were trying to work and didn't necessarily appreciate that. And yes, there was an edge to him. But then, somewhere in the mid to late 80s, Tom went on the radio. First, he subbed for Larry King, then they gave him his own syndicated show. And in my opinion, that's where Tom became humble.
Mm.
There is, you know, he loved the radio. I'm not sure he did in the beginning, but he loved the radio. He loved the intimacy. And he said, the camera's always in focus, the makeup's always right, the wardrobe's always perfect. And then Tom, he did 3 hours every night, but that last hour was just him and phone calls. And he loved that more than anything else.
Yeah.
In fact, when we did the talk show on CNBC and CBS, when a guest would cancel, you know, the staff would feel like if we don't find another guest, we're not doing our job.
Right.
You didn't want to go to your boss and say, we're just doing Tom and phones for the second half hour, even though that's what he wanted.
Mm.
And then Tom would say to me, why can't we just do Tom and phones? I said, we'll do a little bit, but, you know, it's going to look like we're lazy. But when he did Tom and Phones, occasionally on a TV show with no guests, but for an hour every night on his radio show in the mid to late 80s, he loved it. And it brought him closer to the people, and I think he became humble. I think he became less edgy, less obnoxious, less all those adjectives on that ad that they made for him at Channel 7.
Yeah.
And you know, having been with him for all these years, you could see the rough edges coming off him, and I thought it was wonderful.
Which isn't to say that
if you needed him
to
be a hard ass on somebody, he would do it, but he would do it in a nice way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you watch the interviews with Johnny Rotten, for example, and you could tell, you know, that he was pissed off, but he held it together much more than, say, Johnny Rotten did, or that interview with Stern, for example, when he was filling in for Costas. how, you know.
Which, by the way, Howard Stern was two different people. During the commercial, he acted really nice and pleasant. And then when the camera light went on, Stern went into that shtick again. By the way, you brought up Howard Stern.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask me who is the best interviewer, talk show host today, I would argue that you'd have to put Howard Stern in the top two or three. If you listen to his radio show now, and I would recommend it, one he did about a year ago with Madonna, Howard has really become, and I believe even the New York Times and the Washington Post has written about it, but I saw it before. He puts, personally, he puts a lot of himself into it, and he's basically an old Jewish guilt-ridden guy afraid to die. So he's got his own insecurities that he talks about, and he researches. I mean, he does so much research. I mean, he's interviewing Madonna. So then you were moved into a flop house on the Lower East Side. What was that like? And he is amazing. Why? Because he's having a conversation. He's not doing an interview.
I was always a big fan of Imus. And so I always found him, I mean, that was how he conducted the interview, that it was not an interview, it was a conversation. And I think all the good ones, like Snyder, like Charlie Rose, like Cavett, for example, always viewed the program like that, the broadcast like that, that it was a broadcast, but it was also a conversation.
Other than Charlie Rose, I don't know those other people you mentioned are even in this business, but it right at the moment. But I sometimes try to pitch talk shows, and I try to, and the minute I say we're going to give somebody 8 minutes, you can see the blood draining from their faces. Let alone saying we're going to go to commercial and then we're going to do 7 minutes afterwards. I mean, I would love to find somebody, and I know who they are, who could do a Tom Snyder type of program today, but I couldn't get anybody. I couldn't convince anybody to give me that kind of a platform. So, everybody thinks that the viewer is a hummingbird in the shoebox.
So in 1999, why did he leave the Late Show? I mean, was it because they wanted Jon Stewart in that time slot, or?
Well, I think the Stewart thing had fallen apart. He went to Paramount, and by 1999, I think Stewart was already well ensconced at Comedy Central. But the contract was over. Tom was 65 years old, and was always going to leave on top. So we never got to the point of finding out whether he would have been renewed or not. My guess is no, but it was, it was handled in such a way because Tom, I think he just set his mind to it. I'm out. I don't want to, and this is me guessing, Tom thinking, I don't want to find out if I'm going to be invited back. He always mentioned Jerry Seinfeld going out on top. I think that was a huge motivating factor. He admired the way Seinfeld went out. And conversely, we always made jokes about, what was that guy? Here's Larry, the guy from MASH, who quit MASH and then went to another show.
McLean Stevenson.
Went out to McLean Stevenson. We always made jokes about that. And Tom, it was very important to Tom that he leave at the right time. I talked to him about watching Willie Mays as a 42-year-old New York Met bobbling a ball in center field. I was at a game. I was like 12 or 13 years old, and it was embarrassing to see Willie Mays, the great Willie Mays, as a New York Met out there. And so I don't know the answer to that question, and I really don't want to know whether he would have been renewed or not. But he turned 65, and he went on the Internet, and
he applied for Social Security.
Did he miss broadcasting at all?
There were times. He said no. He said, but we had a mutual friend by the name of Bob Long, another wonderful man who passed away last year. At the time, Bob Long, since the early 2000s, Bob Long was the news director at KNBC Channel 4 in Los Angeles. And Bob's ex-wife was Tom's co-anchor back in New York. So we all had history together. And Tom, of course, considers himself to be one of the builders of KNBC in the 1970s. He was very attached to the KNBC Channel 4 newsroom. This is 20 years later.
Mm-hmm.
He still had a lot of DNA, and he still had a lot of skin in that game, and he still watched Channel 4 News. And every time Channel 4 News did something stupid, covered a stupid story, or did a tease that was bad, Tom Snyder would call up Bob Long and bitch and moan and complain. And to Bob's everlasting credit, Bob took the call, Bob let him bitch. And I think Bob kind of knew that Tom was getting sick, ill. But for a guy in his mid to late 60s to be so wrapped up and so concerned with the performance of a newsroom in which he worked more than 20, maybe 30 years earlier, shows that Tom still cared, and I'd bet you he missed it.
Yeah. And so in the retirement years, you'd keep in touch right to the end, didn't you?
We had lunch. We had dinner every Thursday.
Yeah.
Tom was a member of the Bel Air Country Club. And the deal at the Bel Air Country Club is you had to pay $300 a month in fees whether you used it or not. So on Thursday night, the grill room was open late. And he bought me a cheeseburger or whatever I wanted every Thursday night. And that was our ritual. And I loved it so much. And this is the Bel Air Country Club. And you turn around, and there's James Woods walking in. You turn around, there was Pierre Cossette, the great director.
Yeah.
Vin Scully, the play-by-play announcer, is walking in. And they'd plop down, and I was a kid. I knew enough to just keep my mouth shut.
Yeah.
So, yes, the nights at the Bel Air Country Club, I mean, you know, a kid of concentration camp survivors like me from the Bronx, this doesn't happen. And I miss those days every day. Today is Thursday. We would have been there.
Yeah. Well, what would he like to drink?
Vodka.
Yeah.
Anything with vodka in it.
Yeah. What?
He was from Wisconsin, so occasionally, as he said, the beer fairy would come.
Right. Right. Yeah. Thinking about him, and you know, because he's been gone for 10 years and off the air for longer than 10 years, he is a significant figure in late night, and it's unfortunate that people don't remember him or don't know of him. I mean, he ought to be remembered, right?
I try my best, but you're right. Another friend of mine just told me a story the other day. He had a cocktail party, and at the cocktail party was the former chief of staff to the New York mayor, Bloomberg. And this friend of mine who worked at Channel 7, Doug Johnson, was talking to this, really high-powered, brilliant guy working for Bloomberg, and Tom Snyder's name came up, and the kid says, "Who's Tom Snyder?"
Yeah.
So then Doug calls me and says, "This is going to make you feel old." But 10 years is a long time. I mean, there are... you know, as we sit here and wait for the OJ decision, and it's probably happened, he says here his request for parole
has been granted. Yeah.
Yes. So, but there are people today who are following this story who have no idea what happened 20 years ago, no idea, you know, Camp OJ in downtown LA where all the cameras and all the lights were, and they have no idea about Geraldo Rivera doing OJ every single night.
Yeah.
And where it was. And they're just now learning about it through these movies and miniseries that are winning all these awards. And it's the same thing with Tom. But little by little, you know, if you follow him on the internet, there are people coming out of the woodwork and posting more old interviews.
Yeah.
And people talking, and certainly when he was doing those rock and roll interviews, that's where you get the traction. They're not going to talk about the Robert McNamara interview, but they will talk about Wendy Williams. They will talk about Howard Stern. They will talk about Johnny Rotten, because those are the subjects that tend to get reviewed, written about in books, and done as a behind-the-scenes, behind-the-music documentary.
Yeah.
And they will see a clip of Tom Snyder, and they will say, who the hell is that? And then they'll start Googling. They will always talk about the interview with John Lennon with me more than they'll talk about Manson.
Yeah. And people, a lot of people watch that Manson interview. Someone on YouTube's actually posted some of those opening monologues from the CBS show. And I watch them now, just marveling at his ability to talk to an audience.
Yeah. You should watch the night Costas. I think it was the last night of Bob Costas' show. And he was going to hand it over to Greg Kinnear, or was it the other way around? I don't remember.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was Costas' last night on the show, and they expanded to 2 hours, and they were going to do it live. It was just a way of thanking the audience. They were going to do a special show. So at the end of the last segment of that show, Costas says, well, at the NBC television network, who else is up at this hour except for Tom Snyder? So they cut to us in Burbank. And just because it was cool, because Tom, we were still at work, because we're doing a late-night show on CNBC. And watch the show, because Costas is interviewing Tom. But at a certain point, Tom cannot get... He could not stop himself. Tom starts interviewing Costas. Why are you leaving?
Yeah.
Why are you giving up this show? And at a certain point, if you had just turned on at that point in the show, you'd think it was Costas being interviewed by Snyder. It's just the personality was so outsized that it just happened. And I watch it. It's on YouTube. Watch it because it's so hysterically funny. You got these two great broadcasters, but one is definitely outsized.
Yeah.
And the other thing that we can't forget that these late night talk shows these days are completely a different animal. I think Tom would kill you if you ever suggested doing a late night show in front of an audience.
Yeah.
He would absolutely go bonkers. Who needs an audience? It's an intimate time. He was in your living room at 1 o'clock in the morning, or even at 10 o'clock at night when we were doing CNBC, which would be rebroadcast at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And these days, they're not producing shows. I think Colbert is. They're producing segments that they hope get retweeted and watched on social media. So you're watching Jimmy Fallon do a segment. Then they go to commercial, and they're doing another segment. But it's not a show.
Yeah.
There are a good show, a TV show, is like a concerto. You've got highs and lows and ups and downs, and you refer to one segment, the previous segment, and the next segment. And maybe you ask a guest to stick around for the next segment for the next guest because maybe some magic might happen. But nobody thinks like that anymore.
Yeah. You know, this time has just whizzed by, and I find that I could talk to you for another hour or more. Because there's just so many stories that you have. I mean, we just talked about Snyder mostly, but I mean, you know, you produced other things. You were Eyewitness News, as we mentioned earlier, and you know.
That's a whole other podcast. But call me back, and we'll do it again.
This has been fun. I really appreciate you doing this, and you'll never know what this means to me in terms of getting to talk about someone who I've greatly admired.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that because there are fewer and fewer of us.
Yeah. Well, the Twitter handle is @MichaelHorowitz, and Michael Horowitz joined me on the line from Los Angeles and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.